to alter Indian-controlled Kashmir's demographic character. And we will discuss how Muslim women in BJP-ruled India are being degraded and dehumanized through online auctioning.
Under the Hindu nationalist BJP government in India, Muslims have been pushed to the margin, denied basic rights, and at times punished for asserting their identity. Today, members of the minority community live in perpetual fear. They have become strangers in their own land. In recent months, Muslim women have also woken up to this harsh reality. Brazen attempts have been made to degrade and dehumanize women through online auctioning, triggering outrage and leaving the government embarrassed.
On January 1st, after the world rang in the new year with celebratory fireworks, many Muslim women in India woke up to see themselves being auctioned online. It was the worst possible start to 2022 for them. Their pictures were posted on an app called Bali Bay, hosted by the GitHub platform, accompanied by derogatory comments. Most of these 100-plus Muslim women were prominent journalists, educators, authors and activists. Users who logged in were shown doctored images of women with the tagline, "Your Bali Bay of the Day." It bore an uncanny similarity to another online controversy called Sali Deals 6 months ago. In Sali Deals, more than 80 Muslim Indian women were put up for sale. Both Bali and Sali are derogatory words used to demean Muslim Indian women in local slang. Although no real sale took place, the auction smacked of the lampooning of Muslim women, brazen audacity of the people involved, and sheer callousness of the concerned authorities. Importantly, most of these women have been vocal about the marginalization of Muslims amid the rising tide of Hindu nationalism in BJP-ruled India. In last 6 months, since the first controversy erupted, no suspects have been questioned and no arrests have been made, pointing to tacit complicity.
Photographs of more than 100 Muslim Indian women auctioned on the Bali Bay app include a prominent film actress, the spouse of a high court judge, the mother of a missing student, a well-known author, journalist and activist from across the country. Unlike 6 months ago, this time many women have broken the silence and filed police complaints against the perpetrators. The controversy has stirred up political tensions as well, with the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party facing intense scrutiny for creating a climate of fear for Muslims.
The fake Bali Bay auction drew anger and outrage across India after several Muslim women featured on the app made stunning revelations on social media. Many came forward to speak to media, while some filed official police complaints against those involved in the scandal. Ismat Ara, a New Delhi-based journalist, whose complaint prompted the Delhi police to file an initial charge sheet in the case, told media that it had been happening repeatedly with vocal Muslim women who highlight issues that people don't want to talk about. Her complaint encouraged other women to speak up as they found their photographs on the app. Quratul Ain Rehbar, a Kashmiri journalist who had reported on Sali Deals July last year, expressed her outrage and disgust in media interviews after she found her pictures on the app. Fatima Zohra Khan, a Mumbai-based lawyer whose name featured in both Sali and Bali Bay deals, had filed a complaint with Mumbai police last year, but apparently nothing came out of it. This time, however, a series of complaints and growing anger on social media has forced the Indian police to arrest four people involved in the scandal, including a 20-year-old man dubbed as the main conspirator. Whether the law will take its own course or not remains to be seen.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Idrisa Pandit, researcher and lecturer on anti-Muslim racism and gender justice. Welcome to the program, Mrs. Pandit. As we've seen recently, Muslim women in India are being degraded, dehumanized, and humiliated through online auctions. Can you tell us what is happening here?
Well, first of all, thank you for your invitation, and hello to everybody who is listening. I think your question is very specific to Indian Muslim women, but you cannot talk about Indian Muslim women without putting it in the larger context of what is happening to Muslims generally in India. So the call that you are referring to was issued the night before we embarked on a new year, and 2 days prior to the call of, you know, auctioning Muslim women online, you have to realize that there was an open call for genocide of more than 220 million Muslims living in India that was publicly made by the supporters of the Hindutva ideology, an ideology that is calling for a Hindu Rashtra or a Hindu nation that is completely erasing the existence of other minorities, but primarily Muslims. This call was a genocidal call for erasing and committing acts of genocide against the Muslims of India. So it's in that context, the next step was the dehumanization, sexualization, and demonization of the Muslim women. And I think, again, it is extremely important to remember that this is not a one-off thing. This is not the first time that this has happened. There is a pattern to this auctioning of Indian Muslim women online. It has been done earlier as well. To answer your question, it's not just a frenzy. It is a deep cause for concern for anyone that advocates for human rights, because the larger issue of the rising right-wing ideology of Hindutva in India should certainly be a concern for anyone who cares for human rights.
Now, there have been two such online auctions in the last 6 months, with prominent Muslim women being put up for sale. Why did the government fail to take swift action on this matter?
Well, the government is not just failing. The government is failing to even recognize that this is an issue. When a government is party to the very same calls for genocide of Muslims and other minorities, that tells you something about how they are a hand in glove with those who are making such calls. So, a call for erasure of Muslims and attack on the Muslims has been going on in various forms for a very long time, and particularly heightened ever since 2014, after the BJP came into power. So to just think that this is a sudden thing, it's not true. You know, it's been going on, and people who are members of the political party, as well as serving in positions as ministers, have gone off and, you know, participated in creating hatred and bigotry and asking for targeted attacks against Muslims. So when you say, why is the government not really protecting anyone? The point is, the government has been absolutely silent, including the Prime Minister of India, who's been absolutely silent as all of this has been unfolding. So you cannot, you know, expect people to get any answers when you know that the system itself is involved in perpetuating the problem.
Now let's continue with the questions. Many of these women have been vocal about the Hindu nationalist BJP government's anti-Muslim policies. Now, do you think this could be politically motivated?
So again, we cannot take this as a one-off thing. This has to be contextualized. This is not an issue of women who are just criticizing the BJP party and so on. You have to understand, we're talking about prevalent Islamophobia in India. The anti-Muslim racism that is existent in India currently, and, you know, has been, unfortunately, been perpetuated in the last several years. So you cannot talk about this as being just a typical sexist attack, just like attacking women or categorizing it as misogyny. It is much more than that. I mean, yes, misogyny might be the underlying thing, but it is pure hate for people who, or particularly in this case, women who identify themselves as Muslim. And women that are vocal advocates and writers and thinkers and speakers on issues of injustice. So when you auction these women and you dehumanize and demonize these women, it's a tactic for silencing them. So, or creating this atmosphere of fear, because you know, when you target somebody and you do that online, all sorts of crazies get involved. I mean, you have to understand and read about the individual stories of these 100 women that have been targeted. What sort of targeting takes place? You know, what materials they receive. There are threats to their life. So it's just being used as one another tool to intimidate them and silence them and humiliate them. But it needs to be viewed in the larger context of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism that is heightened and escalated in India currently.
There you have it, Mrs. Idrisa Pandit from Ontario, Canada. So glad to have you on the program. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Indian journalist Shyam Meera Singh says he wants to apologize to all Muslim women in India on behalf of Hindus for what he terms cowardly acts by some Hindu extremists. Dr. Amina Kandasamy, a British Indian author and poet, blames police inaction for continued online harassment of Muslim women in India. She calls it a mix of Islamophobia and misogyny. New Delhi-based journalist and activist Ismat Ara, whose photos too featured in the auction, says it's sad that as a Muslim woman, she has to start the new year with a sense of fear and disgust.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
The Narendra Modi-led government's controversial measures in Indian-controlled Kashmir continue unabated, further widening the trust deficit between New Delhi and the people in the troubled Himalayan Valley. In the latest move, that again stirred up a hornet's nest, a series of real estate MOUs were signed to attract outside investments in the region. While Indian authorities hailed it as, quote, a historical transformation, parties in Kashmir across the political and ideological spectrum slammed the move as an attempt to alter the region's demographic character.
Development journey. My heartiest welcome to...
On December 27th, a total of 39 MOUs worth INR 18,900 crore were signed at the Jammu and Kashmir Real Estate Summit, the first of its kind summit in the region.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, a historic moment today.
The MOUs are related to the residential sector, commercial projects, hospitality, infrastructure, finance, film and entertainment. While Indian authorities in Jammu and Kashmir have termed the signing of MOUs a historical transformation, political parties in Kashmir affiliated to both pro-India and pro-freedom camps view it as part of Narendra Modi government's project to change the region's demography. People's Democratic Party chief and former Jammu and Kashmir chief minister Mehbooba Mufti denounced the summit as brazen loot aimed at annihilating the identity of the Muslim-majority region. Her party spokesman said it was the beginning of a process to disempower and disenfranchise the people of Kashmir. National Conference leader and former Chief Minister Omar Abdullah also slammed the move, saying it revealed the true intentions of India to put the Union Territory on sale. A spokesman for Indian National Congress said the party would resist the bid to undermine the rights of Kashmiris. Huriyat Conference, a conglomerate of pro-freedom groups in the region, called it a step towards demographic change and disempowerment of Kashmiris in a bid to prevent the settlement of Kashmir's long-standing political dispute.
The process to alter the Muslim-majority region's demographic character gained momentum 2 years ago when the Hindu nationalist BJP government in New Delhi revoked Kashmir's semi-autonomous status. The move, choreographed to integrate the disputed region into the Indian Union, sparked outcry both at home and abroad. But the Narendra Modi government stood unfazed. In the middle of the pandemic last year, it passed a controversial domicile law that marked a giant leap in the mendacious project of demography change. The latest move is seen as a follow-up to that.
The move to put Kashmir on sale by the BJP-led government in New Delhi has revived a dark chapter in the region's turbulent history. Under the controversial Treaty of Amritsar in March 1846, the British had sold Kashmir to Gulab Singh, the Dogra chieftain whose family ruled the region for one century, for 75 Lakh Nanak Shahi rupees, a local currency. It set a dangerous precedent, which is being repeated now. Under the present political dispensation in New Delhi, Kashmir has been battling against all odds to preserve its Muslim-majority character. The battle became particularly intense 2 years ago when the BJP government revoked the region's special status by abrogating Article 370 and Article 35A. Article 35A allowed only Kashmir's permanent residents to own property. Its abrogation was seen as a recipe for disaster. In July 2020, New Delhi used COVID-19 lockdown to pass a controversial domicile law, which constituted a big step toward changing the demography of the Muslim-majority region. It allowed outsiders to claim jobs or even residency in Kashmir, which naturally irked Muslim Kashmiris. The latest move of inviting outside investors, analysts believe, is yet another key step toward changing Kashmir's demography and eliminating the possibility of a future anti-India referendum.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Muzamil Ayub Tekor, the president of World Kashmir Freedom Movement in London. First of all, thank you for the interview, Mr. Tekor. Let's begin with the Indian government's recent real estate summit on Jammu and Kashmir, which has stirred up a hornet's nest. What do you make of it?
I think the hornet's nest was already stirred long ago when the BJP government came into power. They have a particular agenda, and they know exactly what they're doing, and they've openly said it. It's been in their manifesto for years. They want to create a pan-Hindu nation, and Kashmir is one of the first projects that they have. Secular colonialism and demographic change is a real thing happening inside Kashmir, and we've seen the beginnings of that recently. But we're also going to see further forms of not only just violence, but the perpetual denial of the people's rights inside Kashmir.
Mr. Tekor, the People's Democratic Party has called it brazen loot. National Conference says Kashmir has been put on sale. Hurriyat Conference believes it's a move to disempower Kashmiris. Now, are these fears legitimate?
I think before we discuss whether the fears are legitimate or not, I think the first thing that we need to talk about is the fact that the National Conference and the PDP have no representative, they do not represent, never have represented the people inside Indian occupied Kashmir, nor have they ever represented the sentiments inside Indian occupied Kashmir. The reality is that these people have played puppet to the regimes inside New Delhi, be it the Congress or the BJP. They've always been their puppets with, you know, the strings being pulled by New Delhi. The reality is that the National Conference and the PDP have now had those strings cut, and they still want to play in the theater that India is manufacturing. That is the one reality. On the other side, the All Parties Hurriyat Conference are the legitimate representatives of the sentiments inside Indian occupied Kashmir. We never generally keep those two entities together. And the reason for that is that the All Parties Hurriyat Conference wants the emancipation of occupation from India, whereas the National Conference and the PDP simply want to remain in power. They want to remain relevant. Although that they may be speaking the same language right now, that there is a plan to loot Kashmir, there is a plan to eradicate Kashmir and Kashmiris, the reality is that the people in the National Conference and the PDP simply want to to be at the helm of affairs. They want to maintain their power, their protocol with New Delhi, whereas the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, although talking about exactly what India is doing inside Kashmir, they want to make sure that the narrative is set. They want to make sure that the narrative is not deterred nor diluted, that we want complete and utter freedom from India, despite whatever overtures India are perpetuating inside Kashmir.
Mr. Tukur, there is a perception that the move is designed to alter the Muslim majority region's demographic character and in turn eliminate the prospect of anti-India referendum in the future. What's your take on this?
It's an excellent point, because we've seen the way that Article 370 and 35A safeguarded the sovereign nature, or rather the special status of Kashmir. But even then, it's not something that we aspired for. It was a provision put in place until a settlement of Kashmir was made. By India revoking that and then downgrading Kashmir's status from a state to a union territory essentially means that any Indian can come into Kashmir, purchase land, live in Kashmir as a domicile, essentially being as equal to any Kashmiri Muslim. If that happens, which is happening now, they've started to flood these non-Kashmiris into Kashmir. When the local population is going to be diluted and an external alien population is going to be installed in Kashmir, the demographics are automatically going to be changed. And I have no doubt that at that point, India would be more than willing to hold a plebiscite or a referendum inside Kashmir. Once the locals are diluted or they've been thrown out of Kashmir, the foreigners that are going to be placed there, that are going to outnumber the locals, would of course vote for a BJP government, would of course vote for a referendum. They would vote to stay with India. So this is very real. Not only is India perpetuating demographic change and settler colonialism, they are going against the United Nations resolutions itself. They are going against the Geneva Convention. So these are not, it's not just about what is happening to the local population, it is about international law as well.
Last but not least, sir, by not taking into confidence the pro-India political parties in Kashmir on such critical moves, do you think the BJP government in New Delhi could be playing with fire?
I think you're right that the BJP government is playing with fire, but it's fire that they've created themselves. It is in complete control in their hands. They know exactly what they're doing and what direction they're going to take it. The so-called mainstream inside Kashmir, the pro-Indian parties, at this point in time have no relevance. The Indian government in historically have created these people. They made them into heroes and they've made them into zeros as well. So whether they remain relevant or not, there will always be new people that India will install and create as new leaders, create as new so-called champions of the Kashmir cause.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Tukur for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Imran Khan, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, accuses New Delhi of brazenly violating the UNSC resolutions and committing war crimes by seeking to alter the status and demography of Kashmir. National Conference spokesman Imran Nabi Dar says his party will speak against what he calls the unconstitutional and unlawful acts by the Indian government in Kashmir. Gohar Gilani, a Kashmir-based journalist, quotes the head of Mission Statehood J&K as saying that India is bent on changing the Himalayan region's demography, history, identity, and culture.
And that was our episode about Muslim women in India facing rampant online harassment and the Hindu nationalist government's sinister agenda to alter Kashmir's demographic character. Thank you, everyone. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
In the occupied Golan Heights, the population of settlers and Syrians is approximately equal, but experts fear that a new Israeli regime project will turn Syrians into a demographic minority on their own land, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article titled "Zionist Regime is Tightening Its Grip on Syria's Golan Heights by Creating Facts on the Ground." Stay tuned for more. On December 15, 1981, the Knesset, the Zionist regime parliament, enacted a law officially annexing the Golan Heights, Syrian territory captured by the Zionist regime during 1967 Six-Day War. Now, 40 years later, the Zionist regime hopes to double the size of Jewish settlements there by the end of this decade in an effort human rights activists see as further normalizing a forgotten occupation. Last month, the Zionist regime approved a $300 million plan to promote Jewish settlement expansion in the occupied Golan Heights. In response, Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in the Occupied Territories, and Al-Marsad, the Arab Human Rights Center in Golan Heights, submitted a letter to Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit and the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett this month, demanding the plan's cancellation, given that it is a violation of international law to build settlement on occupied land. Attempts to normalize the occupation of the Syrian Golan have no validity in international law, and the status of the Golan Heights remains occupied territory, Adala attorney Sohad Bashara said in a press release. The Zionist regime has yet to respond to the organization's letter. Currently, about 28,000 settlers reside in 34 settlements in the Golan. They operate 167 settlement businesses and control 95% of the land. The new initiative seeks to double the settler population in the Golan in 5 years by establishing two new settlements and relocating or building factories in the region. The aim is to add 23,000 settlers and construct 7,300 housing units. It also wants to boost the population of Katzrin, the largest settlement in the Golan, by 50,000 residents by 2040. The expansion of settlements in the Golan Heights not only violates the rules of international humanitarian law and human rights law, but also deepens the discriminatory reality against the natives concerning their rights to use natural resources, Al-Marsad attorney Karama Abu Saleh said, adding, this exacerbates the situation whereby settlers have privileges in receiving budgets and access to natural resources, while the natives are suffering from land shortages and other crises. In 2019, then-President Donald Trump signed a proclamation declaring the Golan Heights as part of the fake regime of Israel. In doing so, the United States became the first country to recognize the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the occupied Syrian territory. 2 days after the Zionist regime's official annexation of the Golan Heights in 1981, the UN Security Council used Resolution 497 to determine the Knesset's Golan Heights law as null and void. Today, most of the international community considers the Golan Heights occupied. The Zionist regime decided to build a settlement in honor of Trump to be called Trump Heights as a thank you to the former president for his executive order. Trump Heights is part of the development plan to increase settler population in the Golan. While Trump's action altered the U.S. West Asia region strategy, it did not change the global status quo. Adala attorney Bishara reiterated, telling Minfresh News, the declaration of the Trump administration in this regard did not change anything on the ground. It has, of course, its international implications in terms of how Israel perceives this acknowledgement. But in terms of international law, the annexation and any recognition by any state, including the U.S., does not change the status of the area as an occupied territory and the Syrian community there as a protected community under international humanitarian law. Al-Maqsad's founder and director, Nizar Ayyub, said that Trump's declaration increased settlement activity in the Golan, with many settlements adopting expansion projects. A few years ago, settlers were around 19,000 to 20,000. Now there are about 28,000 to 29,000 settlers, Ayyub said. But Trump's decision isn't the only factor speeding up settlement expansion efforts in the Golan. The Israelis are taking advantage of the situation going on in Syria and the destruction of the Syrian state. Wael Tarabia, director of Al-Marsat's Economic, Social and Cultural Rights Program, told Minpress News, so this is the opportunity that they are using to cement their grip on the Golan. After the Zionist regime occupied more than two-thirds of the Syrian Golan during 1967 war, 95% of the population was displaced and banned from returning. The Zionist regime forces destroyed the area's infrastructure and built settlements using the rubble from the razed villages. But the speed at which the settlements expanded was slower than what the Zionist regime hoped. The heart of the Golan is almost empty because the policy of the settlers since the occupation was to go as far as possible toward the Syrian ceasefire line and to create facts on the ground there. Today, only 27,000 Syrians remain concentrated in five villages, Majdal Shams, Bogata, Masada, Ain, Aina, and Qajar, in the northern Golan. Settlers and Syrians are approximately equal in the number now, but Al-Marsat's Tarbiya believes that the new settlement project will turn the Syrians into a demographic minority on their own land. He explained, the main point is ignored and denied all the time, which is that the other Syrians who were uprooted from their lands count at more than 500,000 and no one is talking about them. No one is talking, for example, about the right of return for the Syrians as we talk about the Palestinians. That's why we call it a forgotten occupation. And everybody is treating the Golan as if it were a normal expansion of the Israeli place. And amid the crisis in Syria, the Golan Syrians are left without a voice, Tarabia said. Because of what's happened in Syria in the last decade, the people here are helpless and they feel helpless. If you look at the local media, you will find that the reaction from the side of locals to the Israeli regime settlement plan is very few compared to what we used to see in the past years. And this explains that the people of the Golan, the Syrians, do not have any political support or representation. Despite most of the global communities recognizing the Zionist regime's occupation of the Golan Heights as a violation of international law, the oppression is largely absent from international headlines. Adalah attorney Bishara surmised this is because public attention has been preoccupied with Syria's war, ongoing developments in the occupied Palestinian territories, and a raging pandemic. With the occupation of the Golan less of a violent land grab compared to the volatile situation in Palestine, the Zionist regime's injustice against Syrians gets pushed aside. As less focus is drawn to the issue from an international perspective, within the Zionist regime's cabinet, the occupation becomes further normalized. Bishara included, it seems that the Golan Heights is becoming consensus because even Meretz, an Israeli left-wing political party, members voted in favor of this decision, which says that there is a consensus along with the whole spectrum of the Israeli political arena, from the right wing to the so-called left Zionist parties. Golan's remaining Syrian villages control less than 4% of their own land. This is because the Zionist regime designated the occupied Golan Heights as state land, meaning the Israeli regime determines its use. While turning some of it into military training fields and outposts, other portions were allocated as nature reserves and national parks, and the largest area is reserved for settlement development. A severe housing crisis emerged out of the Israeli-made land shortage, a problem that will only be exacerbated by the settlement plan. Discriminatory land policies have made it nearly impossible for Syrians to receive building permits, forcing them to build illegally and risk demolition orders. The Zionist regime authorities have issued 1,570 demolition orders since its annexation of the Golan. As a result, many Syrians have had to pay exorbitantly high fines, go to prison, or have their homes demolished. Al-Marsat Tarbiya speculated the settlement expansion plan may benefit local construction businesses, but overall, the Syrian Golanese economy will suffer. The economic situation will become worse and worse with time, Tarbiya said, explaining how, along with settlement growth, the Zionist regime hopes to transform the Golan Heights into the Zionist regime's renewable energy capital. Last year, the Zionist regime approved a plan to build a giant wind farm on a fifth of the Syrian agricultural land in the Golan, significantly harming the natives' health, environment and economy, and depleting their natural resources. Tarbiya said, "That's why people feel that they can do nothing. We are a few people without any kind of support." But he argued that the Syrian communities are not in regular confrontation with the settlers, but rather the Zionist regime is their main source of friction. When we talk about the housing crisis, people don't connect it directly to the settlers. They connect it to the policies of the Zionist regime, because we deal with the Zionist policies and Zionist authorities, Tarbiya said. They are the ones who reject our need to expand the villages.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Zainab. Now, listeners, this is the program The Last Savior, and we had been talking about the false claimants of Mehdi. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure again invite Dr. Murtaza Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, doctor.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation again.
My pleasure.
Everyone is interested in knowing when will the Imam come. And we are seeing some claimants around who give us the approximate time that the Imam is coming by. So for example, 2022 or like something like that, they come up with some approximate dates. Do we have something like that in history?
Of course, not all these people are, false claimants or even bad people. Sometimes they are very good people and some even good preachers. But we are not going to mention the exact time for the reappearance of Imam Mehdi, alayhi salam. There is a negative point to all these claims. in the short term, maybe some people would be glad that, yes, you see, this scholar, for example, told us that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear in the following 10 years, so they would be very happy. But in the long term, it is very, I may call it, destructive to the notion of Mahdawiyah and the concept of waiting for the Imam, may Allah hasten his reappearance. Why? Because 10 years pass, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam does not reappear. What happens to the mentality of the people who, during all these years, they thought that, based on the statement of the scholar, for example, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear after these 10 years?
They get disappointed.
Exactly. The conclusion is a kind of disappointment and despair. It doesn't only happen one time. You see, this person says that, I mean, it would happen in the following 10 years. Another person might say that, I mean, after 15 years. If all these years pass and nothing happened, gradually speaking, I mean, people would be disappointed. And even some people may lose their, I mean, belief in the concept of Mahdawiyah, because they have been told about different dates and none of them was true. And so in the long term, these even approximate times, they are destructive to the notion of waiting for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And the next point is that, beside that, we have some people who do what we call it 40 days of prayer and supplication. Is it against religious laws? No. But unfortunately, sometimes we see that some of the righteous people, they are very good people. They say that, and they use the public media and social media and, I mean, different networks. So they ask all the people that for the following 40 days, every night at 9 p.m., we will come together and say and read the following supplication. And inshallah, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear after these 40 days. I'm not saying that this is something bad. The point is that it's very important the way you are preaching this idea. Sometimes they preach that in a way that the addresses of these preaching, they come to this belief that just after these 40 days, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear. Because all the people around the world, they are, for example, praying for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Yes, we need to pray. We are asked to pray for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But you should not explain it exactly. So that there is an expectation for the people that right after these 40 days, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear. Again, imagine the first chilla or 40 days pass and nothing happens. Another group comes and say that let's do another 40 days. And inshallah, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear. Again, it doesn't happen. So when it is repeated for a couple of times, again, we have a kind of disappointment. Next time when you ask the people that let's do the prayer and supplicate for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, some of them, they are not going to do that anymore. And some of them, they will become disappointed and despair of the whole concept altogether. So these are some negative points which are related to setting even an approximate time for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi.
So far you're trying to say that setting an approximate date or giving a possibility of that Imam will be coming back by this time, by these many years, is not only incorrect, that the person is getting into some, like, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, you said that, says that, tell him that you are a liar, and do not shy saying him that you are a liar. Not only this person is kind of committing a sin himself, but apart from that, these people are disappointing a group of people, disappointing numberless people who have hopes to these approximate dates. And then when they see repeatedly Imam not coming on these dates, they get disappointed, they fail in despair, and they kind of lose hope, and they do not believe anymore, or they do not even come into supplications anymore.
Exactly.
All right, Dr. Karimi, we'll be talking to you. Here we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. lives in your old
So what is the duty of the Shia? The Imams of the Ahl al-Bayt, they have mentioned in the narrations that be away from any kind of tawqid, setting a date. Pray for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. As I mentioned, I'm not saying that people should not say the prayer, but to give this expectation that right after these 40 days, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come, this is wrong way of preaching and asking the people for supplication. So according to the narrations, people and the Shia need to be ready for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam in any time. So, and I mean, it has very positive psychological effects on the Shia. The fact that every day I'm hopeful that maybe in the next Friday or Saturday, because there are different narrations on the date of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, Imam Mahdi will come. And as a Shia, I need to be prepared for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. Am I ready this week if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam reappears? So this is the positive effect of waiting for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. On a daily basis, we need to be prepared. And if you look at waiting...
There is not a particular time that we need to wait for. This particular time, Imam come anytime, and we need to, our duty is to be ready. I would like to add a story over here.
Sure.
This is my personal experience. Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala faraja, is someone who every religion believes in. There are Hindus who call him Lord Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
There are Sikhs who call him, you are some guru. And there are so many others who call him by different names. There is someone who is going to come and fight injustice in the world, fill the world with justice, what we all believe in. Now, I want to tell a story over here. I used to live in an apartment wherein we had all these people together, like we had people from different religions. And when at night I was spreading the curtains on the window, I saw in another apartment next to our apartment was a apartment wherein they were from Sikh, and they always used to carry this sword kind of thing, a very small sword kind of thing. And we just thought that this is for their personal security. And when I saw that they are sleeping right now, but why are they carrying this sword at night? Next morning, I was very curious to know. I asked this girl, I told her, like, I was putting on curtains on the window, you were also doing the same thing, but I saw you in night suit, and at the same time, you had this sword. What you have got to do with this sword at night? And the lady comes in and tells me that our leader is coming, who is...
Oh, to that extent, they tried to be
they were in a position of, like, what we call in Persian as Amade Bosh. They were in a ready state that Imam is coming, even at night. So that was really amazing for me.
That's very interesting.
So like that, you're trying to tell us that Shias need to be prepared anytime, not just after a particular 40 days or like 20 days, 10 days. We need to be prepared in day, in night. Imam can come anytime.
This perspective would change our lifetime considerably. If people are told that, okay, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear in 2030. So I would say that, okay, for 10 years I may do nothing, and then in the last couple of days I will try to prepare myself. So it would change my life in a negative way. But the concept of intizar, or waiting for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, as you rightly mentioned, is to be prepared for his advent and reappearance in any time. What is confirming this point is the fact that according to some narrations, the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is just like the Day of Judgment. It happens suddenly. And this is very interesting. And I think many Shia, they have not paid enough attention to this point, that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come in a time that maybe many people would not expect
all
him to come.
All
of a sudden. And there are narrations like this. For example, it was told to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear, and the Prophet says that his reappearance is like the Day of Judgment, only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows that, and it is hidden for the inhabitants of the heavens and the earth, it would come all of a sudden, baghtatan. And in another narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam regarding chapter Zukhruf, verse 66, says that the hour in this verse is referring to the hour when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will begin his uprising and he will reappear, which would be again, all of a sudden.
All of a sudden.
Yeah. Imam Mahdi alayhi salam himself, in a narration in one of his Tawqi'at, our affair, our issue, which is referring to the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, will happen all at once. Again, my point is that all these narrations are referring to the fact that at any time, as Shia, we need to be prepared, and we shouldn't be surprised by the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We may think that it would be far from us. But according to these narrations, we need to be waiting for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and expect him to come
any
time, and we need to be prepared. But we are absolutely forbidden from setting any time for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, whether it is in the form of an exact time or even an approximate time. As I mentioned, it's set even approximate time would bring many negative consequences in the long term. The next point, which is related to our topic, is about the doctrine that is known as Bada. Maybe we need a separate session to talk about this very important concept, which is attributed to Shia school of thought. But the point is that Bada, in its true sense, is something mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran, and all the Muslims believe in that. But unfortunately, because some people have a kind of misunderstanding of the concept of Bada, they have thought that this is only the belief of the...
And we want you to expand that in the next session,
okay,
inshallah. It was really, really helpful that we don't need to set times, and if we set a particular time, then we are not going to prepare ourselves, and we are going to be missing something very important, and that is when Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said the best thing of the Ummah, when there will be no Imam, will be the time when they will be waiting for the
mm-hmm.
Imam, and we will be kind of, you know, making ourselves away from this ibadah, from this worship, from these rewards. So the best reward is in the waiting. Thank you so much for being with us on the show. Inshallah, we'll be inviting you next time. Till then, this is Zainab Askari with the whole team saying goodbye. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.